organized. All right, for today's biography, we're actually going to be talking about Andrew Vanderbilt, who is better known as Brother Andrew. I think most of you may have heard of his name as Brother Andrew. So for today's story, we're traveling to Holland. Andrew was born in 1930, and he was born in a very small sort of sleepy town called Witt. And his father was a blacksmith, so they were a fairly poor family. His mother was an invalid most of her life. And although the parents were Christians and attended church very regularly, Andrew didn't. And this was why. His father was quite deaf, and so every time they went to church, they had to sit in the front pew. But the front pew wasn't quite long enough. And so for the whole family couldn't fit on that front pew. And so Andrew used to always hang back very obligingly, and his mother would tell him to find a seat somewhere at the back of the church. And in the first hymn, he would run out the back door and play in the fields or skate down the canals or do anything he liked. And then he would always, with great precision, find his way back into the church for the last hymn and pick up a few comments about the sermon and so on to drop in over lunch. And his parents had no idea of this for many, many years, for most of his childhood, in fact. And so Andrew never went to church, really, although his parents did. He was quite the prankster, actually, when he was growing up. He was often involved in a bit of mischief. He was very, very brave and courageous and did all sorts of wild and foolish things. One family in the village that was the butt of most of his pranks was a family known as the Westerers. And these people were genuine believers, and he didn't like them for some reason, even as a child. He didn't like their God bless yous and their please pray for us, or we will pray for you, and all those phrases that they used to use all the time. The other thing that he didn't really like about this family was the fact that, well, they kept talking about the Germans and the impending doom and war again and all sorts of other things like that. And everyone in the village used to wave them aside and think they were over-exaggerating and overreacting. But when 1939 came around, it was proved that this family did, in fact, have some sort of idea of what was going on in Germany. The family owned a radio, and soon enough they heard that Holland was at war. And all the army was called up, the reserves, all the private cars were taken and so on. And there was a general mobilization of troops. In April 1940, there were more refugees pouring into Holland and Witt and that little town where Andrew lived. And there were many of these were Jews. And soon Holland was actually bombing some of its areas, some of the dikes, and flooding some of the parts of their farmland and so on. And this was because they predicted the Germans would invade by land, and so they were trying to slow their advance. But in May 1940, when the family was sat around their little radio listening, suddenly the radio was drowned out by the sound of planes going overhead. And the German planes came that very night and blitzed Rotterdam, the nearest big city. And so on his 12th birthday, Andrew found himself in the midst of war right on his doorstep. Rotterdam was gone, and on the next day, Holland had surrendered. Now, at first, the German invasion didn't affect him too much. I mean, of course, there were German soldiers in the village and everything, but because Witt was such a remote and small kind of town, they didn't send their best and finest. In fact, the lieutenant that they did send and his small company of German soldiers, well, they were a little older and they were a little overweight. And so Andrew stepped up his pranking, and every night he used to sneak out and do all sorts of really daring things. And his mother was very worried about him, but she let him do this. He used to get fireworks and blast them off at the entrance of the lieutenant's place. He used to get all sorts of, he even got a cherry bomb, and he put it in front of the lieutenant's house so that when the guards walked past, it exploded and caused a lot of problems. He poured sugar into the car of the lieutenant as well, and did all sorts of things day after day, night after night, actually. He was an extremely fast runner, and so he could easily get away, although he didn't count on the fact that a lot of these soldiers had guns. And so, you know, even as a young child, he was quite, well, you could say foolish, but he was also quite daring. But soon this wore off because the rations came. And at this time in Holland, particularly towards the middle of the 1940s or sort of 1942, the rations were so severe that their family of six was living on rations for two. And Andrew remembered this period of time as just constant hunger. He was never satisfied. And he noticed that his mother was always giving away her food as well. And so she was on the brink of starvation. Not only that, but there were raids through all the towns. Trucks used to come and get any able-bodied men to come and fight for the Germans. He used to, when he heard the trucks were coming, he used to run into the forest. They used to dive into canals and swim. They did everything. And soon even his father had to do that because they were taking anybody. Soon there was no electricity. There was no coal. They had to chop down the ancient elm trees that was surrounded their village. They were eating tulip bulbs and bark to supplement their diet. But finally, in 1945, the Canadians came in. They heard that the war was completely over. And on the next day, Andrew ran 8 kilometres to the nearest Canadian camp and begged them for a sack of bread or something. And they gave him a sack of breadcrumbs, which he took back to his family, and his mother cried tears of joy. Now, after this time, Andrew was now about 18 years old. He lacked a lot of direction. You see, it was common in those days that the son would then carry on the father's business, but he had no interest in being a blacksmith. And he tried to pick up other trades, but, you know, he just didn't stick at anything. And his father gave him an ultimatum and said, "You must find something and stick to it, and that's going to be your job. None of this messing around." So he did, but it wasn't the trade his parents were particularly happy about. He decided to join the army. At this time, after the Second World War, the Dutch East Indies were starting to fight for their independence. And so the Dutch were trying to recruit more people, and it was very easy for him to get into the army. And he loved it. The training, everything was just suited him perfectly. He was very, very fit. He was a very good runner. And soon he was noted to be, was picked out to be part of the special commando unit. And so he just loved this significance that being in the army suddenly gave him. It was wonderful to wear a uniform and walk through the village and everyone sort of to be cheering him on and so on. And he really used to, you know, talk to people and say, "Yes, I'm off to the Dutch East Indies very shortly and I'm in the Special Commander Unit." He used to love telling people this because he felt so significant. He felt that this was his meaning and purpose in his life. And many people reiterated that, except for the Westras. Mr. Westra one day sat him down and said, "I'll be praying for you, Andrew. And I'll pray that this adventure you find will actually satisfy." And Andrew thought this was the strangest thing to say. Of course it was going to satisfy. He was going to get out of that town, that's for sure. And of course the world would be at his feet. He'd be travelling. Why would this adventure not satisfy? So in November 1946, as a part of a special commando unit, he left Holland and made his way to Indonesia. And on the day he left, his mother pressed her Bible into his hand and said, "Please, Andrew, read it." And he threw it in his duffel bag and gave it no further thought. His time in Indonesia was shocking. It was so different to everything he had trained for. He was totally unprepared for what he met. Firstly, he was fighting people who were not in uniform. He was sweeping through villages, killing men, fathers, sons, children. And he was really shaken by the things he had to do. The other thing was that they hadn't counted on and they hadn't really had training for was landmines. And there were nests of landmines scattered everywhere around villages. And it put them so on edge that at the end of one particular operation that lasted for 3 weeks straight, where they were skirting through villages and constantly under fire and so on, they came to this tiny little village, and one of their men obviously stepped on a landmine and revealed that there were landmines scattered everywhere in that area, and the company, on the edge of their nerves and soaked in exhaustion, they went berserk, and Andy amongst them. And they went through that village and killed every single person that was alive. And at the end of that moment, when he came to himself, he looked, and there, just lying on just a few meters from him, was a woman holding a newborn baby, and both of them had been killed by the same bullet. And when he saw that, it sort of burned in his mind, and he was a broken man. At that point, he actually wanted to kill himself then and there. When he walked through that village and saw the carnage that he himself had done, without any command, there was no real reason, he just couldn't bear it. But he didn't kill himself. Instead, he lived with a death wish. He did everything in the extreme. He and a couple of other men lived by this motto: get smart, lose your mind. And that's exactly what they did. He used to wear that yellow straw hat instead of a helmet. And of course it would draw fire. People would see it, and he would actually sing out, "Shoot me, here I am." And he would walk out onto the battlefield. He would do the most crazy things. And at the end of operations, he would go and get raging drunk and rampage through towns. And he lived in the desperate hope that he would be killed. But he never was. And he wrote to his friends back home. And he just tried. He couldn't tell them everything, but he wrote something of his guilt. But every time he got a letter back, it was just cheering him on and saying, "You know, you're serving king and country. Good on you. Don't worry about those little details. The details don't count." But one person he did write to, and who responded a little differently, was his girlfriend, Teal. He had met her in Holland while he was training. And she was to his eyes, very religious. She took Christianity very, very seriously. And when he wrote to her and mentioned just a few little things about how he was feeling, of course not everything, she wrote back and told him about forgiveness and told him that he needed to find God, and this was his answer. Well, he didn't think much of that, and he also thought, she doesn't understand. She has no idea what it's like out here. So he continued life as before, just living as wildly as he could, living with the hope that he would be killed. One day, he was on an operation somewhere, and a bullet went through the top of his hat, scraping the top of his scalp. And then another bullet came and smashed straight into his ankle. And he remembered falling over while he was running, and he looked down, and there were two holes on either side of his boot and blood pouring out both sides. And he, of course, was taken on a stretcher and taken to the hospital. And he was devastated, because this was the irony of it all. In everything he'd wanted to do, in this great adventure, he'd not even succeeded in getting himself killed properly. Here he was, very much alive, with a smashed up ankle. He probably would never really be able to walk properly again. He certainly wouldn't be able to run, which was his main skill. And so there, lying in this hospital bed, facing surgery and all sorts of other things, he realized that there was no great adventure on earth, and nothing would satisfy. Well, two small events happened while he was there at the hospital. And these two tiny things changed his trajectory for eternity. The first thing was a letter. In a drunken state one time, he had written a letter, which he did address to his girlfriend, but he didn't write an address or anything. He had no intention of posting it, because in this letter, he wrote down everything that he had done that he was so utterly ashamed of. And he wrote everything down as a way of unburdening himself. All his guilt was in on those few pieces of paper. Now, when he went to hospital, a very helpful friend gathered all his possessions and saw that unaddressed envelope and found the address pretty easily and wrote the address on it and posted it and went and told Andy how helpful he'd been. And, of course, Andy went white as a sheet and was about to throttle the guy, but he didn't. and he just thought, that's it, life is over as we know it. That letter, he remembered it very clearly, he knew what was in it, and now that had gotten into the hands of his beloved Teal. The second thing was the nurses. Many of the nurses who worked at that particular hospital were believers, and they were voluntary nurses there who were working as part of in this army hospital. And one of them had seen the little Bible, the Dutch Bible that was in his bag, and had put it on his bedside. And as the days and weeks went by, you know, Andrew was starting to notice how cheerful these nurses were. They were always had this wonderful attitude. They cared for him so well. And he, in his sort of depressed and angry and bitter state, just saw a huge contrast with his own heart and theirs. And he actually said to one of the nurses one day, he said, you know, what is it? How is it that you can be so, well, cheerful in this horrible, God-forsaken place? And she said to him very simply, the love of Christ. And then she tapped his little Bible and said, you know, you've got all the answers right here. And then she walked off. Well, after that comment, he did pick up his Bible, his mother's Bible, and he turned to Genesis chapter 1, verse 1. The next day, a letter arrived from Teal, and with great anguish and stress and trepidation, with shaking hands, he opened that letter, and he pulled it out, and he didn't dare read it, and then he did, and finally, when he read it all, he realized that she understood. And she wrote with such empathy about the heartbroken state that he was in, and she kind of understood where he was at. And she talked and talked in this letter about needing to understand human heartbreak in the light of God's love. And at the end of that, she said, read your Bible. Here's a study guide. And so, study guide in hand, Bible in the other, he started to read. Now, as he read the scripture, you know, he was drawn to it. But he didn't really even understand why it was that he was so drawn to the scripture. And soon he was posted back home and he continued to read. And he was so engrossed in it that sometimes he would just lie in his bed and just be reading. So much so that his father, who thought this was very unusual behavior, actually thought this might have been a symptom of shell shock or something like that. And not only that, but some of his friends who were believers took him to different churches, and soon he started attending different meetings and groups and so on almost every day. And his family were quite worried about this huge change. But he was really seeking something. He was desperately drawn by the scripture, but he didn't quite know what it was. One night, when there was a big storm and he was lying there in his little loft bed, he kind of was thinking about all the things he'd read and heard, and he put it all together. And he prayed out loud to the Lord, and he prayed a very, very simple prayer. He said, Lord, if you show me the way forward, then I will follow you. And in that moment, he had so much peace, and all that sort of desperate seeking kind of just faded away. And in the morning, he had this great need that he wanted to tell someone. He didn't even know what he was going to tell them exactly. But he went to the Westra straight away. And he said to them, he told them how he was feeling and what he'd prayed. And they understood straight away and said, you've been saved. You've been born again. And praise the Lord, about time. This is an answered prayer. And so began Andy's very new life. He was a very enthusiastic Christian in these early days, and he went to lots of different meetings, and soon he heard this idea of being a missionary. And this kind of stuck to him. He liked this idea of being a missionary. And somebody one of the speakers, spotted his great enthusiasm and went up to him and said, you know what, the best training for a missionary is to start at home, where you are. Start there. And then you'll be clear about whether this is your calling or not. And he took that to heart. And so he decided to get a job at his local chocolate factory in the nearest town. And he decided that this would be his mission field, because he would start here at home in his everyday life. Well, nothing prepared him for this factory. He got a job packing, and when he realised his particular job and the people he was working with, he was quite shocked. Every other person on that factory floor was female. He was the only male. And not only that, but they were the most rough and crude group of women that he'd ever met. Even his time in the army had not prepared him for this. He was the butt of all their filthy jokes. He was bullied by them. They used to tease him constantly. Their swearing, the crude language. It was horrible. And he was shocked. And he didn't know what he should do. But then he realized that, well, he knew exactly what he should do. This was his mission field. This floor, this factory floor that he was working in daily, was where he was meant to be. Now, there was one lady there who was kind of behind the counter. I guess she did sort of the orders or something like that. And she was such a young, innocent, lovely, sort of delicate lady that he felt so sorry for her and kind of said to her one day, "You shouldn't be working here. This is not the place for you." But soon he realized that she was actually a believer, and she'd been praying for all those women on her factory floor for a long time. And so the two of them ended up working together. You see, he was sort of up and around on the floor, and he could hear conversations that were happening. And a lot of these women were from really, really rough, difficult backgrounds. And so he would hear things, you know, maybe their needs or things that had happened to them. And he would tell her, and she would be able to somehow find practical ways to help them. She would pray for them or speak to them one-on-one. And so soon the two of them were ministering to these girls in really practical ways, but also praying for them constantly. And gradually, over many, many months, this factory floor became a very, very different place. Many of those girls were saved, not all, of course, but many. And it was a changed environment. Now, Andrew kind of knew that although this was a really wonderful experience, that this wasn't the end of the road. This was training. And he really felt that the Lord wanted him to do something else. And he still had that idea of being a missionary. But you see, on the one hand, he thought, "I am the worst candidate for a missionary, really." He'd left school at the age of 12 when the Germans invaded. So he really didn't have an education. It was pretty basic. And his ankle still was no better. He used to have to limp around everywhere. He used to sort of ride a bike and stick his ankle out, and so he could sort of roll down places and so on. Because he walking was hard. He couldn't even walk around a block without having to stop and sit in pain. And those girls on the factory floor used to call him Grandpa. So he thought, you know, what is the point? How could I be a missionary? I'm the most useless of all the different people out there. He knew some of his other friends who were going to Bible college to be missionaries, and comparing himself, it was just ridiculous. But then on the other hand, he did feel that this was sort of the right thing. But then he didn't trust himself as well, because was he just interested because it was another adventure? And he didn't know what to do. One day he was praying, and he sat in a sort of a remote, lovely kind of area outside his town. And there was no one around, so he was praying out loud and quite desperately, asking the Lord what to do. And suddenly he realized that every time he was thinking about this, he was always saying, "Yes, but," instead of just, "Yes, Lord." And so out loud that afternoon, he said to the Lord, "The answer is yes. And I'm going to go with you wherever you want me to go. And right now, I'm going to stand up," and he stood up, "and I'm going to take a step of obedience." And he took a step. And then he said to the Lord, "That's my step of yes. I'm just going to say yes." And as he stepped down, there was a crack in his ankle, and a pain shot up his leg. And then he took another step, and another, and then he started his walk home. And suddenly he realized that his ankle was quite stable. And he put all his weight on it, and it didn't hurt. And then he realized that the Lord, in that moment of his obedience, had completely healed his ankle. Now, of course, I'm cutting a long story short here, but he ended up, Andy decided that he would go to Bible college. And he found a particular Bible college that really trained people, not just in theology, but really to have faith and live by faith. And this was a Bible college in Scotland, in Glasgow. But with all these changes and all this talk of being a missionary, Teal didn't feel so comfortable. She really hoped that Andrew would take the promotion that he got at the factory and maybe just settle down and just focus on the factory. But now he was thinking of missionary, talking about Bible College Scotland. And she looked up this Bible college in Scotland and found it wasn't really affiliated to any church. It wasn't like connected to a university. It wasn't like he was going to have a degree. And it just didn't, she was not comfortable. And she didn't share his idea or vision of being a missionary either. And so she said to him, if you go to Bible college in Scotland, and if you want to become a missionary, well, that's the last you're going to see or hear of me. And that was such a blow to Andy, because he had actually he wanted to marry her, and he had actually envisaged their life together. She had been so helpful to him over the years and encouraging him in his Christian walk. And now this ultimatum, it just seemed too much for him. But he had such conviction, and he knew that the Lord had honored his obedience, and he knew that he was meant to be a missionary, and he knew that he needed to go to Glasgow. And so he did. And he never saw Teal again. But that wasn't the first time that his obedience had a price to pay. Now, when he was at Bible college, when he almost finished Bible college, he came across a magazine. And in this magazine, when he opened and there was a two-page spread, he saw this big advertisement for a youth festival in Warsaw, Poland. It was now 1955, and this was a new thing, these youth festivals across Eastern Europe. And anyone was invited. And so he wrote to them, and he said, you know, I'm a Christian, can I come? And he got a letter back within a week, which said, yes, of course, you're very welcome. Anyone's free to come to our youth festival. Of course, it was a very official visit. There were official tours. There were official things that needed to be done. You had to stay in certain accommodation, and everything was very much worked out and sorted. And so when he went over to Warsaw, he was overwhelmed by the number of youth that were pouring into the country. From 114 different countries, thousands upon thousands of young people were just coming to this huge world festival. And there were people everywhere, you know, with banners that shouted the benefits of socialism or communism. And he felt overwhelmed, like he was just this one person in a sea of all these people who were pretty much saying, God is dead. On this official visit, he managed to try and ask people if they knew where a church was, and nobody seemed to, or nobody would tell him. Finally, someone told him where a Bible shop was, and he went there and discovered that the Bible shop had been closed and the owner was on holiday. And later, he, as they were doing an official tour, he did spot a church. It was a big building. And so he snuck away one Sunday, and he got to this church, and he found that it was quite full, actually. There were many people there, and he was quite surprised. He had this impression that in Poland, now that communism was there, things would be tighter. But here was a church, and there were many people. At the end, he spoke to the pastor, and pretty much the pastor sort of said that, yes, we're all free, everyone's free to come, as long as we speak the things that are approved along party lines. And if we just make a few little small compromises, then we'll stay open. And so Andy started to get this impression that, yes, it had the appearance of being free and open, but there were people watching all the time. People at that church gave him the address of another, and he went to another church and later on that day, and he discovered that the congregation was all older people. There were no children, there were no youth at all. And he went to another one the next week. They kept giving him addresses for different places. And he noticed the same thing. Churches were there, but congregation was all elderly. On his very, very last morning in Poland, he woke up really early before dawn. And he wanted to think about all these things that he'd seen and pray for the different people he'd met in the different churches he'd visited. And as he was walking through the streets, he heard the distant sound of marching. And he could hear this crowd of people coming. And he watched as this huge parade, known as the Parade of Triumph, came through the streets to mark the end of this youth festival. All these young people in their red ties were marching together, clapping in unison, yelling about the fact that man was his own master, the future was their own. The effect was so overwhelming for him. And he realized that he was seeing the new evangelists of this era, the communists. There was no one forcing these youth. They were doing it on their own accord. They truly believed in the benefits of communism, the fact that they were their own master, that God was that God was dead and the state was their God, in a sense. And as he looked at the sea of thousands of people, suddenly a verse came into his mind. Be watchful and strengthen the things which remain that are ready to die. He had to actually look the verse up later because the verse came to his mind, but he didn't even know where it was. And he knew that that was from the Lord. And he also knew that this message was his mission, that the Lord wanted him to strengthen the church in these countries that were starting to be a little bit closed off to the rest of the world. And he had already witnessed the fact that many churches were starting to compromise and many believers were starting to be very fearful. But how could he, one man, amidst this world system, do anything? 96 million youth had signed up across the world to join the Communist Party and their different organizations. Everyone was actively embracing communism at this time. And what could he, one little guy with very little education and experience, do? But then he remembered back then, and he remembered his step of yes. And he also knew that one man with God is a majority. Now, at this time, communism was just beginning, and the spread of communism was happening like wildfire after World War II. And although there was at first an appearance of freedom, it certainly wasn't like that the minute you scratch below the surface. You see, pastors and leaders who refused to compromise or deliver their political messages and so on, they started just to disappear. They just disappeared. Nobody asked too many questions. Soon Bibles became very hard to find. Bible shops started to close. And then people lived in great fear of owning a Bible, because if you did go out and buy a Bible, then you were registered. And they checked your attendance to the official state-run churches. And if you weren't there, then you would be watched and perhaps arrested and questioned for your involvement in other things. Soon Christians were looked at as unpatriotic. And to be a Christian meant you were going against the progress of the country. And so soon believers were not able to get jobs. Children were brainwashed in schools to believe that if you were religious, it was because you're a little bit foolish, stupid, or uneducated. And so only old people, you know, who are really traditional, they're the ones who don't understand progress. They are religious. And so soon children were very much against even their own parents in terms of being a Christian or going attending church or reading the Bible. And many children who had Christian parents were expelled from schools. Businesses that were owned by Christians failed. And pretty much Christians were forced to the edges. But while all this happened, communism was becoming stronger and stronger. In these early years, Andrew did manage to visit many different countries after his first visit to Poland. And so he saw firsthand that Bibles were so hard to come by. He went to a church in Czechoslovakia where a lady held up her Bible over her head, and he sort of was wondering what she was doing. But she was doing that so that the rows at the back could at least maybe try and follow on if they could see it. There were other places where the pastors were preaching, but they had their Bibles confiscated. They didn't own a Bible. They weren't allowed to. And so they were preaching with no Bible. There were places where people were trying to copy out books of the Bible so that they could just take a copy for themselves if their own had been confiscated. And so Andrew decided that he needed to get Bibles to these believers. Now, the Westras gave him their own car. And it was a little car, not very, very particularly a good car, but it was a little blue Beetle. And with this little blue Beetle, he decided that he would drive around communist Europe and deliver Bibles by hand to all the different churches that he found. Now, he kitted out the car a little bit, but soon when people were giving him boxes of Bibles, hundreds of Bibles, he soon realized that hiding them is going to be a little hard in that tiny thing. So he did try and put them under seats and put them in compartments, but then, you know, there wasn't enough room, and so he ended up putting them in his sleeping bag and in his camping gear, and then the leftovers just went in his suitcase. And so, kitted out like this, he thought, well, at least, you know, in a car I can try and find the least patrolled borders and get into countries that way. Because, of course, in Europe you can drive everywhere. So in 1957, he took his full Bible car, his car that was full of Bibles, and he took that to Yugoslavia. And he drove there, and as he did, he realized that these checkpoints that he thought he might just be able to get through, you know, not too many people, they were not just not patrolled at all. They were really strict. And as he stood, he's parked in a line of cars, he looked, and every single car was being checked. The driver had to stand aside, and the guards would just come in. They would throw things out. They would be looking everywhere, confiscating anything and anything that they thought was, you know, against the government in some way. And so he watched this, and he was inching his car forward in the line, thinking, I've got Bibles in my suitcase. If you open the suitcase, you'll see them. I've got Bibles stuffed in a sleeping bag. If you pick it up, you'll hear them. It was too late for him to do anything, though. He couldn't sort of come and quickly sort of rearrange the car in a line with the guards right ahead of him. And so he prayed. And he prayed a prayer that he would pray hundreds and hundreds of times. He said, Lord, you made blind eyes see. Now, please make these seeing eyes blind. And so it was his turn, and he stepped out of the car, and the guards came, and he tried to just sort of say, yeah, no problem, you just check the car, no worries at all. And the guards started, they pulled up the seats, and they grabbed his camping gear, and they plunked it on the floor, and one guard was going through it, and was pulling out his camp stove, even checking inside his camp stove, looking inside his coffee jar, and looking into his sleeping bag, and Andrew was thinking, okay. And then another one grabbed his suitcase and dumped it on the bonnet and flipped it open. And there, in plain sight, even for him to see at a distance, were three Bibles, all sat neatly in a row. And the guard shut the suitcase and threw it in and said, right, get all your stuff, off you go. And he thought, the Lord has answered my prayer. He made those seeing eyes completely blind to all the Bibles that were just in front of them. And so the Lord, over and over again, this story happened so many times, over and over again, the Lord protected those Bibles. And all of them, all the Bibles that he took, managed to get into these countries. But there were other challenges. The checkpoints was just the beginning of it. The other challenge was the fact that as the countries became a lot more closed and more dangerous, then, you know, it was very, very hard to even trust anyone. You couldn't just sort of ask for directions and say, I'm looking for Pastor Joe here. Do you know where he lives? You know, you couldn't do that. You couldn't trust people. You might be talking to someone who's a member of the secret police who's been looking for Pastor Joe for the past year. So you couldn't just do that. You had to either find your way yourself or be very cryptic. You couldn't write letters to people that said, "Hi, I'm just going to be delivering some Bibles. Would you be free at 3 o'clock? You couldn't do that because all your letters were censored. And so finding contacts and being able to contact people was another huge issue. Now, the Dutch Bible Society did know people across Europe and different pastors and leaders and so on. And there was a pastor by the name, or a leader, I don't even know if he was a pastor, there was a leader by the name of Jamil, a Christian man. And this address in Yugoslavia was given to Andrew. And the people in the Dutch Bible Society said, take the Bibles to him. You know, we know him. He's trustworthy. Take them to him. Here is his address. We have his home address, so you can go directly to his home and discuss further. And so Andy wrote a very carefully worded letter to Jamil saying that he was a Dutchman and he wanted to see the beauty of Yugoslavia and he would like to visit him and so on. And he wrote this letter and sent it and everything, and he got no reply. But he knew that the Lord wanted him to go anyway. And so he was there in Yugoslavia and he made his way to Zagreb. And little did he know that Jamil had moved house. And that letter had been taken by the new tenants, who just saw the name of the old tenant, and they just took it to the post office. And it sat in the post office for a while, and then finally somebody remembered to do the forwarding address, and they quickly did a forwarding address and put it in the mail. So it was weeks and weeks late. And Jamil, when he finally received the letter on the day, he thought, "This Dutchman? Who is he? Is he to be trusted? What should I do? Should I?" And he knew that the only way that he would meet this guy is if he went back to his old house. But, should he bother? Because he knew that the letter was weeks late. Maybe this Dutchman had already gone. You know, and of course, there's no times and dates on these letters. And so he thought, well, I'll just catch the train there today. And as he was walking towards his house, he thought to himself, Jamil was thinking, this is ridiculous. You know, I can't ask the tenants. I can't say, by the way, has a Dutchman asked for me? You know, you're just going to be attracting attention. And he couldn't just wait there on the street for a whole day. That would also attract attention. Now, Andy knew none of this. And he and his little blue car was coming down the street. And just as Jamil, sort of thinking to himself, stood in front of his house, the little blue car parked outside. And Andy looked, and Jamil looked, and they knew that they'd found each other straight away. And Jamil, in an instant, realized that he was definitely going to be able to trust Andy because the Lord had orchestrated this appointment. And through Jamil, Andrew met so many other believers. He, of course, had lots of contact, different churches. He even knew someone who could interpret for him. And so Andy was able to travel and preach, or not preach, they used to say, give greetings from Holland to different gatherings around. During this time in Yugoslavia, it was very, very, very clear what the strategy of the government was at that time. The strategy was very simple. It was to target children. And there was propaganda everywhere. Children were taught constantly in schools that religion was poison. That maybe their parents did go to church, but if they did, dob them in. That's the right thing to do. And so it was so clear that the government was aiming everything at the youth, knowing that that would have the biggest effect. And soon, lots of people started to view Christians as really sort of stupid and uneducated people. And families were torn apart as children dobbed in their own parents. In Macedonia, things were very tough there. And there weren't many churches that he was able to visit at all. So one day, he was told that he would be speaking to some believers in a particular area. And as they drove, they stopped in the middle of a field. And Andy said, well, is this it? And they said, yes, this is it. And they waited there until after dark. And then after it was completely dark, they could see little bobbing lanterns coming from all directions. And Christians had walked from different villages to meet in this isolated field so that he could preach to them. And they could hear about the word of God. And he realized that there was like sometimes one Bible amongst several villages that was carefully passed around and copied. Even the children at school were persecuted. There was one little girl who told how she had, just out of habit, given thanks before eating her lunch in the playground. And a teacher had come straight away, right up to her, and told her to stand up and said, "How dare you? How dare you thank God for your meal? You don't thank God. God didn't provide this. The state has given you this meal. How dare you? Do that again and you'll be reported." But the little girl did do that again the next day. She gave thanks again, knowing that it was God that she needed to be thankful for. And she was expelled from the school and unable to get an education from then on. Communication was another factor. In Romania, things were very difficult, and it became almost a strategy of the enemy to make Christians suspicious of other Christians, because that isolated people. And so this was what was happening in Romania at the time. And it was so very difficult because many Christians had been daubed in by other seemingly genuine Christians, other believers. And so everyone was so wary. And even Andrew, when he was delivering Bibles, he couldn't just sort of say to this person, "Oh, I've got my Bibles in the car here. Do you want them? You know, he had to be careful who he revealed this illegal cargo to. And so it was sometimes very difficult to know who to trust. And Christians even were not very open with him either, because they didn't know whether he might have been a member of the secret police or just under some cover to see if they wanted Bibles, and if they would receive them, then they would the secret police would pounce. So it was difficult. On one particular occasion, he was meeting some leaders, some pastors of a church in Romania. And they sat at a table opposite each other, and this old, frail-looking pastor sort of eyed him, and they soon realized not only did they, you know, they were sort of suspicious of each other, I guess, but also they had no language in common, and there was no translator. And so Andy was thinking, "I can't just show them the Bibles. I don't know if it's the right; these are the right people to give the Bibles to. You know, perhaps the secretary and the other people in the room, that some of them might be Communist Party members, we don't know." But then he had an idea. And he saw in that little office, there was a little Bible, a Romanian Bible. And he got it out and he put it in front of the pastor. Then he got out his own Dutch Bible. And he decided that he would use the Bible to speak, communicate. He opened to 1 Corinthians 16:20, and he pointed to the reference, and of course Numbers, and the book was fairly easy to recognize. And so the pastor turned in his Romanian Bible and read out, "All the brethren greet you." And the pastor's face kind of lit up. And then the pastor quickly turned in his Romanian Bible and he turned to Proverbs 25:25, and Andy read in his Bible, "As cold water to a weary soul is good news from a far country." And as quickly as he could, Andy turned to Philemon. I thank my God, making mention of you always in my prayers, hearing of your love and faith which you have towards the Lord Jesus. And the pastor broke into a huge smile and said, "We have great joy and consolation in your love, because the hearts of the saints have been refreshed by you, brother." And so, those Bibles, those Romanian Bibles he had, he knew he could trust this man, and he handed over those Romanian Bibles. And those Christians were absolutely overjoyed. They couldn't believe that these Bibles were for free, and they clutched them to their heart. That's how much they wanted to read the Lord's Word. Back in Holland, Andrew had met another girl. In fact, he'd met her before. She was the lady at the factory who he had worked so well with. She popped up again in his life, and they discovered they both shared the same call. But, you know, what a sacrifice it would be to be the wife of Andrew. For a start, he would be away at months at a time with no possibility of correspondence at all. He had a super risky job with absolutely no pay, and all he had to offer her was a room above a tool shed that was really quite mouldy. So he actually, when he proposed to Corrie, he said to her, "You'd be absolutely crazy to say yes, but I hope you do." And just to make matters worse, he had to rush off to another smuggling trip, a Bible smuggling trip to Hungary, and she had no way of contacting him, but she was left to think about that and to think whether he would, whether she would actually say yes or not. And after a while, when he came back, she did. She said yes. And you can imagine what their honeymoon was in communist Europe somewhere. But on the day that they were engaged, Corrie said to Andrew, "We don't know where the roads will lead, but you know what? We'll just go there together." And that really summed up her self-sacrificing attitude, because he was true to his word. He was away for months at a time. He had very, very risky work. She found it really hard. And sometimes she joined him, sometimes she wasn't able to. And it was a very, very hard life for her. But she valued his work and shared in it. Now, Christians, as he travelled through Europe, he just saw time and time again Christians who were absolutely overjoyed to just get a glimpse of a Bible in their own language. And he saw this unending need for Bibles across all of communist Europe. And he was just one man in his little car driving around. And, you know, he knew that if he could just have one other team doing this or one other person doing this, then he would double that joy, maybe triple it. And when he shared this with Corrie, she literally shouted for joy. And, you know, because he was, at that time, they had two children and she was often at home alone and he was always missing all the significant events, the birthdays, the first words, the first steps, all of that. So the idea that sharing the workload, she thought it was a wonderful idea, although she admitted a little selfishly. Now, lots and lots of people had expressed interest over the years. He'd spoken at different meetings in Holland, and people used to come up to him, mainly young men, and they said, "Oh, can I come? Can I come on the next one? Can I come with you? I'd really love to do it." But he never really felt free to sort of say, "Yes, I'll take you on board." And the reason for that was because so many people liked the adventure, and he knew where that type of thing led. He needed a worker. He didn't need someone who just wanted to have a little peek behind the Iron Curtain, or someone who just wanted the status to say, "Yes, I went to communist Europe and smuggled Bibles." He needed somebody who could be truly used by the Lord. And finally, the Lord gave Andrew and Corrie the same name separately. They both thought Hans would be a good person to ask. Now, on the outside, Hans was not a good person to ask. Firstly, he was really, really tall, and it meant that he couldn't really fit in that tiny car. Second, he was extremely clumsy. He spoke the most atrocious German. And the other thing is, he couldn't even drive. And he'd been, like, people had tried to teach him to drive, and he just couldn't drive. He just couldn't pick it up. And so the fact that they were driving over Europe, it just didn't seem that he was an obvious choice at all. However, the Lord had given them that name. And so they talked to him and they asked him. And, of course, he ended up saying yes. And they found that Hans was an incredible storyteller, and he could talk to rooms full of people and have them spellbound. He also did learn to drive in Europe, and he also, what he made up for in his lack of practical skills and so on, he made up with daring, and he was he trusted the Lord entirely. There was one occasion when they were stopped by some police, not at a checkpoint, they were just randomly, I think they'd stopped to make a cup of coffee on their camp stove. And the police just out of nowhere came and descended on them and wanted to check their car. They had Bibles on the front seat. And Hans said, "We must pray. Pray the same thing that you prayed all those years ago. Make those seeing eyes blind, Lord." And Andrew was sweating, you know, in the fear of it all, but Hans was sure that the Lord would protect his word, which yet again he did. Having said all of this, you know, there were times when they went into countries and they had Bibles and they wanted to hand it over to some leaders, church leaders and so on. And these leaders said no. And this often happened in places like Russia. Many of those pastors had been so tortured and beaten and imprisoned and endured things that we cannot even imagine, that when they came out and the opportunity of them owning a Bible came up again, they often said, "We can't do it. I just can't do it again." And so Andy also saw his work as trying to strengthen these people, these bruised reeds. And of course, you know, we can't judge, because what they endured, particularly in Russia during that time, was really unthinkable. Now, as the team grew from Andy and Corrie and Hans and more, a couple of other couples, young couples, joined them, they started to expand their work. And they actually went to China. And in China, the situation was quite different, because in these early days, you know, they actually tried to leave leaflets and things in hotel rooms, sometimes just on park benches and things like that. And people would literally come after them and give them back. And so Andrew took to actually getting Bibles and giving them out to people on the street. And people would take it, look at it, and give it back. He literally couldn't hand anything over to the Chinese people during that time. And he found that the situation was quite different, because there was a huge indifference. Everyone was very satisfied with the way things were in China. And as he started to visit different Bible colleges and churches, he soon realized that these were not Christian places at all. And many of these Bible colleges were just places where political, you know, messages were sprinkled with a little bit of Christianity were taught. And essentially, these were places for Communist Party members. There was nothing Christian about them at all, except that they had a title or a name. And so his work in China was very different, and he found it a very different place to Europe. But over the years, he actually managed to deliver over 1 million Bibles into China. And one of his big operations, a pretty daring one, was where he loaded a ship full of Bibles and he floated them on barges to a remote beach in some province in China. And some Chinese believers had gathered at night. Many of them had gathered, hundreds and hundreds, to collect those Bibles as they came to the shore. And by the time the police found out about this, they had disappeared off into different villages and so on, although some were confiscated. Now, as the years rolled on, and Andrew is actually still alive today, he's actually in his 90s now, and from his work that started with just him and his little blue car has sprung an organisation by the name of Open Doors. And of course now the focus has completely shifted. Communist Europe is now very open. It's a very different place now to what it was in the 1950s and 60s. But now their shift has focused they've shifted their focus to the Islamic world, where it is very hard to buy a Bible, where pastors and Christian leaders are disappearing sometimes without any sort of report of where they are, where, you know, the churches and so on are being destroyed, bombed, Christian gatherings are being raided, people are being imprisoned for other crimes, even though it's pretty much for evangelizing or owning a Bible. And so I guess with all of these stories, we can kind of think that this is all in the past. But the things that Andrew experienced are still happening today. And I think it's important for us to remember what Paul wrote in 1 Corinthians. There are many members, yet one body. And the members should have the same care for one another. And if one member suffers, all members suffer with it. Now, you are the body of Christ. This is the reality of the church. It's not just us in our peace and freedom here. It's all of us. And we are all in different contexts and circumstances. But perhaps it's also timely for us to think about, what are we doing with our freedom and our peace that we enjoy in our context now? What are we doing with it to build the kingdom and to equip ourselves for what might come? come in the future. Because we never know when our turn will come to make a very costly stand for the Lord. Thank you.